John Fletcher,
Lowry, a guy named Ted Gray, who I think teaches at the University of Tennessee Law School, maybe. I can't remember that. Grayford Gray. I remember that was his name. But those folks were independent in a lot of ways. They're independent thinkers. They were interested in issues of civil rights more than I was. But I was just in a position to write the letter and kind of provoke the issue with the Board of Trustees.
So you were the president of the executive committee.
Mm-hmm.
Was that unusual for a law student to be the president?
It was in those days, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was not, you know, after that, there were lots of times that happened, but apparently it was fairly unusual in those days.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happened ultimately? There's no happy ending here. He didn't suddenly get an invitation and come.
No.
No Hollywood endings here.
No. What happened was, I think that it was agreed that the university would set up some sort of speakers committee, and if the board didn't like, you know, there was no happy ending. And I think that my guess is that President Cole probably got crunched on that some by us and by the Board of Trustees. I think he probably felt in the middle.
Do you know where he came down on it?
Yeah, I think he came down opposed to the board rescission of the invitation. I'm pretty sure he did. There are probably records around it to authenticate that one, but it's clearly the impression I had that he was opposed to the board's action. But I don't think he ever said anything to me one way or the other. We were fairly close, but he was very circumspect also. I mean, he wasn't going to just kowtow to some jerk student. He was always very friendly and always very forthright. But my recollection is he did not disclose his position to me, but I think it was generally assumed in the community that he thought it was a bad decision to overrule that group and rescind the invitation. I don't know if the invitation was ever extended.
Yeah, I was about to say, who extended the invitation?
The Christian Council extended it. If it was extended, and I think it was. Hodges would know for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But Hodges is a good guy and I love him, but I would rely on John Jacob's letters more than I rely on me or Hodges. And John's got them downstairs, I know. Do you know John?
Yes, I do, from Marshall Library days.
Hmm.
So how would they be filed, do you think?
He has them.
Well, John would know where they are.
Yeah, they were partially the under the Powell papers, but there were also some sort of trustees things that he had down there. If he can't find them, I may have copies of some of them somewhere.
Well, I sure would like to see those. That's something I'd heard about, and it was actually on my list to ask you if you knew anything about it. Little did I know that you were right in the middle of it.
Yeah, I was, and I was sort of the precipitator of it.
So you say you were, and I guess as president of the EC, you had a tight relationship with Fred Cole,
mm-hmm.
as president. What were your perceptions of him?
He was a really good person. A man who had a vision for Washington Lee, and my guess is, and again I don't know, but my sense is that he really improved the morale of the faculty and improved the quality of the faculty, and did that with a Board of Trustees which was probably not as interested in education as he was. I think he probably took the university for several giant steps, just because this is not, my hunch is that the university was not functioning very effectively in terms of its presidential leadership before that, because I think President Gaines was not functioning very effectively. That's the stories I've heard, but we don't know that. But Dr. Cole was careful, thoughtful, and without question, so far as I'm aware, really did bring the faculty along in terms of its salary and in hiring people. I never heard anything really bad about him. Smoked too much. But he's a hell of a handball player. I used to play handball with him a lot. He was very good. He had a way of sort of not being hail fellow well met, but also seemed to know people and know something about them and was generally interested in them. And I think one of the great things he did was hire Bob Murray. You know Bob Murray? That's a name you ought to have to find out what really happened in Washington for 25 years. Bob Murray was the first head of security here. He was security here. And when I was a senior in college, we were such jerks. This is before I went to law school. That in 1958, if you look in the old newspaper files, you will see that this town was outraged by our behavior, as it should have been. You know, we were drinking too much, partying too much. Those Red Square fraternities down there had the arrogance to rope off Henry Street on Sunday afternoon to sell beer and have bands playing out there in the Henry Street Baptist Church, the Black Baptist Church right across the street, you know, be having church or funerals or something. And here you got a bunch of hotshot fraternity guys out there roping the streets off, you know, slobbering beer all over the place. So the town really was pissed off, excuse me. And during the next year or so, you know, just said, you folks have got to be more responsible. And one of the pieces of responsibility was that Fred Cole, I'm sure it was Fred Cole, hired Bob Murray off of Lexington Police Department. Bob Murray was a guy who grew up as a blue-collar kid in Lynchburg, who played football for E.C. Glass High School and had been a policeman in Lexington for years, and had not been particularly friendly when I was here. He'd been sort of friendly to me. I didn't know him well, but he was sort of friendly to me because I played football. But he came up here and he tamed more rampant drunk lions. And there would be a lot of people who would be in jail today and would have serious criminal records had not been for Bob Murray. He just looked out for students. He always knew when somebody was in trouble. He knew when they were getting ready to do something stupid. He knew when they were too drunk to drive a car. He traveled the whole town all the time. Every party weekend, all night, he'd just drive around, look for people, and make sure they weren't doing something stupid or breaking up something. And he was a wonderful guy.
What was his style? How would he do this?
He would hang out, just hang out. He'd hang out around the gym, or he'd hang out in his old sort of yellow car, or he'd walk around the campus.
And one person all by himself.
What? For years, Bob Murray was it, till Burr Datz came to work for him. Ask Burr about him. You know Burr? Burr's now a Catholic student worker for the St. Patrick's Catholic Church. And Burr was in many ways, Burr is still in many ways like Murray. And I've always thought that Burr was God's way of playing tricks on Washington Lee, that went through all this brouhaha about hiring Chaplin a few years ago and decided not to do it. And it's because, it's another story I'll talk to you about, but we pride ourselves in being a secular university or whatever we do. But I always thought it was interesting that Burr, who knew where everybody was buried because he learned where the graveyard was from Bob Murray, and knew every student who was in trouble, who was strung out on drugs around here in the 70s and the early 80s, Burr was touched and he quit that job and became a Catholic student worker. So he was the guy. I mean, it's a question of, it's like, if you read Luke's gospel, all these fancy things are happening in Jerusalem, and here and there's the king of this and the king of that, and John the Baptist was born in the wilderness. Well, Burr Datz came out of the wilderness. He came up from, you know, the lowliest part of the university, the security staff, and I think saved more souls and more lives at Washington Lee than anybody except Bob Murray in the last 15, 20, 30 years.
And who is this person?
Burdatz, D-A-T-Z, B-U-R-R. He would not be on Ferris's list. But he really is. He plays music. He just knew where kids were when he was in security. And he knew he was in trouble. And he always knew who was in trouble, and he still knows those folks the same way. But Bob Murray started that whole enterprise. Bob Murray just would hang out. And by hanging out, he kept a lot of guys out of trouble. He helped the guys who were in trouble. And when people needed to be held responsible, he held them responsible. He worked under the Dean of Students Office. From 59 onward till he retired. He still lives here in Lexington. My judgment is my guess is that there are a lot of people who would not have made it into adulthood if it hadn't been for those two guys, and particularly Murray. And a lot of the stuff that I'm proudest of in my life at Washington has come from what I learned from those guys. I remember 10 years ago. There used to be a guy here I knew, a freshman in college, because I knew his dad. He used to meet the Federal Express truck at 8 o'clock in the morning. And there wasn't any reason for him to meet the Federal Express truck at 8 o'clock in the morning. He was buying drugs. And so I did what Murray used to do. I went and said, okay, I know what you're doing. You know I know what you're doing. And if you don't quit it, the community's going to know what you're doing. You're going to be in serious trouble. And never say a word to them about any of it. That's what Bob Murray used to always do. Just to go to folks who were getting themselves in trouble and say, get out of trouble. Quit doing that. I think what makes this place run is Fred Cole hired good people, yeah. But I think it's the Bob Murrays, it's the Boyd Williams, and it's the Burdatzes who have been the stuff that students come in contact with that has been as important as a lot of the intellectual life in this community. I'm sure there are a lot of other people. Those are the ones I know very well.
They sound like real unsung heroes.
Oh, they really are. I mean, but I bet you if you take anybody on any football team from 1959 to 1975, or maybe even 80, and ask them, who's the most important guy in your memory? That either the first, second, or third on that list will be Bob Murray. I don't know if Gene Perry had him on his list or not. But he was an incredible man. He still is. Well, he hasn't spent any time over here now. Maybe at the gym. But there are a lot of those unsung heroes. Guy who ended up destroying himself, he's worked too hard, was Mo Mays, was another one. He was a black guy here, on Buildings and Grounds. He was a janitor in DuPont Hall, and then did another job. He just worked too hard. But he was important for a lot of students, particularly in the early days when there weren't many black students right here. His wife Lucille still is alive. She doesn't work anymore. She used to work in the alumni house.
Gene Perry did mention, he said that the janitors, he said there weren't role models and they had to look for role models anywhere they could, and that the janitors were wonderful people.
Yeah, and the guy in this law school who was that way was Napoleon Borges. Do you know him?
Napoleon Borges?
No, Borges. That his name? Yeah. Yeah, he's Napoleon's still around here. He's a bartender here.
B-O-R-U-S?
B-O-R-G-U-S-S. Borges. I got the right name. I know him as Napoleon. Yeah, and his wife, Dolly. Yeah, Napoleon is on Randall Street. He was a janitor in this law school in the basement for a lot until he retired. By the time he moved over here until he retired, he was the incredible confessor to most of the Afro-American students who gone through here. And another couple of people in town who were that role were Jerry and Pooh Roan.
Yes.
For Johnny Morrison, Bill Hill, Gene's brother, Tony Perry. They're good, they're people you ought to talk with.
You were obviously witness and aware of that whole era of those first black students arriving. What was your sense? Was the university ready for them? What was your sense of what was going on then?
I don't think it was, but I'm not sure you could ever get ready for a change in your culture like that.
Well, they got ready for women on the undergraduate level.
Yes. But, yes, but, let me leave it there for a minute. I gotta go to the bathroom.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Okay.
I think those role models that are most important are the folks outside the main structure. I think Napoleon was one of those. Mo Mays was before he got so broke down, and he finally just, I think, fell apart. But Napoleon was a really important role model to a lot of black students. And Murray, Burdett, it's a combination of kind of not best role models, not so much, it's more confessor. Roger Groot has been one of those guys.
Roger?
Groot. Here in the law school, he's a real confessor to a lot of people. I used to be before I got so old, but you know, when you get old, you don't like paying attention to it anymore.
Well, what was your impression of those first couple of years when the black students arrived? Did they arrive in the law school simultaneously?
The first black student that came to Washington was a law student. Steve Smith. He graduated from St. Lawrence, down in, not St. Lawrence, but St., whatever it is in Lawrenceville, I forgot the name of that school, St. Augustine's. Maybe that's not even it. But it's a black Episcopal college, part of the United Negro College Fund colleges, and it's in Lawrenceville, Virginia, and it's not, I can't remember the name of it. But he graduated there, came to law school, I think in 66, because when I came in 67, he was a second year student, or maybe graduated in 68. And I think he had come here because there was a relationship between Washington and Lee. St. Paul's is the name of the college. Between Washington Lee and St. Paul's, that it was a really poor school, that's destitute, no money. And the old president was a friend of Fred Cole's. And Fred Cole, I think, had been part of trying to get the public schools reopened in Prince Edward County And this is just on the other side of Prince Edward County. And Claybrook Griffith, I think, used to teach economics down there, sort of on loan from here. And maybe Washington may have paid his salary. I don't know that. That was before my, when I was practicing law in Washington at the time. But the first black student was a law student who came from St. Paul and left, graduated here, went to work for the Department of Justice, and was murdered a couple years after he got out. And I don't think they ever found a murderer or anything. But then the college began to integrate within the next year or two. And my recollection is in that first class, was a big guy whose name I can't remember, used to be, he after graduated, became some sort of dean of students office person. Then he went to law school. He left. And then there are two other guys. One is John Morrison, who was Commonwealth, left here and went to the Commonwealth Attorney's Office in Portsmouth. He was raised in the projects in Portsmouth, came here, went to college, then went to law school, and became an incredibly good lawyer, Commonwealth Attorney. Later was named Circuit Court Bench. He's a judge, I think, on the Circuit Court in Portsmouth. And then another guy named Bill Hill, whose daughter may be here now. And Bill Hill was from Atlanta. He was an upper middle class black guy. And I think Johnny's background was probably very different. Bill went back to Atlanta and was in the Attorney General's office for a number of years, then became a judge, and now is a practicing lawyer. Hey!
Well, let's talk about, though, the dynamics of what went on then, rather than the personalities, the dynamics of what happened.
I don't know. I'm not sure I can answer that question. I know in the law school, Les Smith was his name. Les Smith was already a student here. Things proceeded just... My recollection, things proceeded. He took courses like everybody else, did well. I think he was on the law review, and I saw him hanging out with a lot of students. It was not as if he were isolated. I don't know about the college. I know that Bob Huntley was president when that happened, and the dynamics that he tried to work for were in dynamics of inclusion. And I remember him telling me that he'd just been named president, I think. That he made a round of all these fraternities and got word to all these fraternities that, you know, you better pay attention to this part of our community that's coming in here. It was obviously a small part, very small community. So he tried to make it a welcome place. But I don't have a good sense one way or the other because I was in the law school and involved in those kind of things. I just don't remember what was going on.
Okay. Well, let's make a shift. Let's shift our focus to the law school. Let's go back. Let's take a couple steps back to your being a student in Tucker Hall.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about Tucker Hall.
It's a wonderful building. It was a great building. It was a very different, small, personal but sometimes insecure place. You know, I think the law school was better than it thought it was. You know, it always was in the shadow of the University of Virginia in those days. And it was, if you were a Virginia resident, you'd go to the University of Virginia, A, because it was cheaper, and B, because it was better law school. At least it was thought to be better, you know. That's a blue smoke and mirrors thing. It probably was. It was a bigger law school. The law school was very small, and that was just before the threshold time when law schools had that kind of big growth period in the 70s. So it was a small place, had been small for a long time, very collegial, some would say ingrown. The faculty was older and small.
Who was the faculty? Who were the people who taught you and influenced you and had made an impression on you?
Bob Huntley was an incredible teacher. He had been in college. No, he'd been in law school when I was in college, and I'd known him, that kind of leapfrog thing. He'd been in the same fraternity I was before he went to the Navy. I came to school, he came back to law school. He was involved in student politics while I was in undergraduate school in the fraternity. Then I left, he graduated from law school, went to practice law in Alexandria, and came back and started teaching about the time I left college, as well as he was teaching about the time I left college. And then he hired me to come here to teach after I finished law school. He was my teacher in law school.
So he was, tell me about him as a teacher.
He was an incredible teacher. Demanding, never insulting, but always when you thought you had an answer, he took it away from you. He'd make you squirm about it. He just had ways of building a class that made you reach further than you thought you could, but you usually didn't get it. And he had the ability to do that. When he didn't have time to get prepared, I mean, when I was in law school, he was spending a lot of time in the Washington Hall because Fred Cole depended on him. He was president then, and man, Bob was doing a lot of stuff over there. My second year in law school, he was away. I think he was at Harvard getting some kind of degree. My last year in law school, he was back and in full force and full form. But he was also spending a lot of time working for Fred Cole, for the president. And I think he was probably secretary to the university or something by that time. And the story is, and I don't know if it's true or not, but I believe it to be true, that the Board of Trustees was a sort of a self-perpetuating, probably ingrown group at the time. And Huntley would go to the Board of Trustees meeting and go over the minutes from the last meeting and have nothing written on a piece of paper. You just tell them this is what they did. I've heard that story enough to believe it to be true. So he was even then an eloquent spokesman for the university with the board. And then he was dean for a day and was named president. He was dean for one semester, I think, of law school. And then he was named president. But he had all kinds of things going on in his life other than teaching law, but he was an incredible teacher. Even, I know he couldn't have been prepared because he'd been entertaining alumni and drinking whiskey with them and stuff at night, and would come in the next morning for class and it would be, you'd have your mind rung loose. He was a very good teacher. Charles Laughlin was a very good teacher.
Tell me about him.
He was, by that time, an older guy, and his widow still lives here, Hope. She's
her painting.
Her paintings in the hall. She's a very talented artist. He was a wonderful man. And you'll find somewhere, all I know about him, if you look over in those records, because I delivered his funeral eulogy.
But tell me about him as a teacher. I have that, but tell me about him as a teacher.
He was a very pedantic kind of guy. In some ways, always fussing with his notes to make sure they're in the right place or in the right order, but he did love his students, and he loved to teach. He had no pretensions that to be anything other than what he was in the classroom. As a kind of a befuddled teacher, but not befuddled in a bad, but he was just a dedicated teacher. And he always expected things of you, and he never, he'd be disappointed if you didn't do it, but maybe he would somehow think it was his fault. He was thinking when you weren't prepared or something. He's a really good teacher. And never imaginative in the sense that somebody like Huntley was, but he never thought it was his job to be imaginative.
What courses did he teach?
He taught evidence and civil procedure, and later, well, he was imaginative in some ways, because of courses he always wanted to teach, he never got to teach when he was younger and sort of an outsider, but he started a jurisprudence course here. Did a wonderful job with it. He saw procedure and evidence, jurisprudence. That's fire extinguisher. I mean, it goes off every now and then. I don't know what else. Conflicts of law, I think he probably taught for a time. But the school was so small in those days, people taught nearly everything.
Would the same people teach the same thing?
Most of the time, until somebody finally got, somebody died or got tired of teaching that course, then somebody else would teach it. But Charles always, when I was in school, always taught evidence and procedure. And Bill Ritz was an incredible scholar, and probably such a good teacher that we didn't appreciate it. Very soft-spoken, hard to follow, partly because of his soft-spokenness and partly because of his shyness. Had an incredible mind and did some work, which I think was extraordinary work. And people who know that work say it really was, and it was, a lot of was remained unpublished at the time of his illness. He had a stroke and couldn't write, couldn't talk for the last 9 or 10 years of his life, or 9 years. But part of his work was on the Judiciary Act of 1789 that two folks published, put together later. And apparently it is, it's seminal work in the field, and people have to change their opinions when they review Ritz's work. Mm-hmm. But Lash LaRue and another guy put that work together. The other guy's With Holt. They published that book 5, 6, 7 years ago.
With Holt?
With Holt is the other person who was worked on the book with Lash.
So that was Charles Laughlin. Were you a student of Charles Light's?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about him.
He was a dean most of the time I was here, and didn't teach a lot. Taught me constitutional law and maybe administrative law. He was a really good man. I'm not sure that he ever, I'm not sure he and I ever got on the same wavelength as a student and a teacher. Always very friendly, very nice guy, but I can't say. It's not one of those recollections, sometimes you can hit a pitcher and sometimes he strikes you out. I think generally I struck out.
All right, now, I heard a name that I'm terribly curious about, and I don't know anything about this person. Red Eye Johnson?
Didn't know him. I know of him, only never knew it. He was dead probably before I ever came to college.
Okay. All right. So this is going.
I heard of him from Charlie McDowell.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I was hoping maybe you'd cross paths with him. And Skinny Williams?
Is he yes, before Skinny you? Skinny was, may have been dean for a semester while I was here. He taught me property. He was an incredible old lawyer. Very bright, very good. Very demanding teacher. He was the only teacher in law school in those days who made you stand up to recite. I mean, I guess everybody did that one time or another, but when I was in school, nobody did except Skinny.
And what do you mean? Tell me, describe the situation.
Ms. Warren, you tell me about this case. It's S. Stephen Estep against Jones. Well, yes, you can stand up, Ms. Warren. And now, you said that, and why did you say this? And what would you think if, Ms. Warren? And do you find it interesting that, Ms. Warren? And you go on that way. Yeah, he used to keep me on my feet for a whole hour.
He'd keep one student?
Usually didn't do it to one student, but he did it to me.
But you liked.
Sometimes it'd be 1 hour and I'd have to come back the next day and do it again.
Do you know why he was called Skinny?
Because he was just skinny as a beanpole. He was a great hunter and always had a bunch of dogs. And wonderful looking shotguns. And he had been in his earlier life a Commonwealth attorney in, up around Woodstock, up in Page County. But he'd been here, I don't know how long, but he was a legend, and he was a wonderful teacher and a great bird hunter, and I suspect he probably died hunting. He was still teaching the first year I came back here to teach, and died that year.
Was he called Skinny by everybody? Was
never
that his name?
Face. Students always called him that.
Okay, but never to his face.
Yeah.
So what
Dean
was
Williams,
his,
sir.
What was his real name?
Clayton.
I've never heard that. I've only heard of Skinny.
Clayton Epps, E-P-E-S Williams.
That's funny. I've never heard anybody say anything else. How about Charles McDowell, Sr.? Did you have him?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How was he?
He was a great guy. He was a very good teacher. He didn't demand enough of us. But I think in those days he probably wasn't demanding much of himself. He was tired. Was old. Drunk too much. He had drunk too much. But he used to He really didn't learn a lot from him, but he never did demand much till the exam. He'd tell you the same thing, tell you today what he's going to tell you, and he'd tell it to you, and he'd tell you this afternoon what he told you. And tomorrow you might get a sort of a new chapter, but it's not quite. And this, my best friend in life was in law school with me. It was a semester ahead of me, I guess. Some courses and some when we were together. He was a really careful, still is a very careful note taker. And he'd take notes in class, but then at the bottom of each page of his notebook, he would put Charlie McDowell's jokes for the day. And so we knew them all. He had them all in his notebook.
Oh, where are those notebooks now?
Oh, I think he's got them. Oh, call this fellow Joe Spivey. Joe lives here in Lexington. He doesn't live here. He works for Hunt. He's a partner in Hunt Williams, but he's cashed out, and he's here most of the time. Not most of the time, but he keeps a home here. Joseph M. Spivey. But Charlie McDowell used to he carried a Pepsi Cola and a Camel cigarette. And he carried that thing down in the lounge, but back over in Tucker Hall, there was an old bunch of pipes, and they put a Coke machine down, and he'd sit there, smoke that Camel cigarette, and drink on that Pepsi. And ashes of gold in his shirt. But he'd just kind of hang out. In the afternoon, he'd go down to downtown to J. Ed Deaver's clothing store and just talk all afternoon to those old boys. And he'd go in there, and Charlie would maybe grab you, but he'd be in there talking, and he'd talk about you, and then he'd go on talking, and they'd just be sitting there all afternoon. And Catherine ran the law school.
Tell me about that.
She really did run the law school. And Charlie, she came out of Kentucky, and Charlie came from Kentucky also. He had been at Center College and had played football out there in the days of Bo McMillan, who was a big-time, old-timey, 1,000 years ago football player from the Newt Rockne era. And they were both radical for this community. A, didn't believe in God. B, did believe in Franklin Roosevelt. And C, hated the Bird Machine. You don't come to Lexington if you're from Kentucky and not be a Presbyterian, let alone don't believe in God. And so they were, in many ways, marginalized, my guess is, in this community by the good burgers. But they were both very smart. Charlie had taught here for a short time before he went in the Navy Air Corps, I think. And they were in Florida during those years, and then they came back here. And she, I don't know when she started working in Dean's office, probably when they were young. But they used to work at Old Tucker Hall and accused her of burning it down because it was so damn ugly.
Can I ask you to adjust your, yeah, pull it up a little?
And, when I came here, though, she really did run the law school. I mean, the dean's was sort of there, but they didn't have him, you know. If you wanted something, you went to Catherine's office. And she was very thoughtful of people and students. And she used to be a buffer between students and faculty. If we got unhappy with the faculty, she'd sort of cool that down. And she'd help you find jobs. She was a placement director, sort of, and everything else. She was a really an amazing woman, very bright. And all those who know say an incredible bridge player. I never played bridge with her. She had that kind of mind. And even after Charlie died, she must have worked 10 more years. She finally retired. No, more than that, I guess. She worked until we came to this building, and she wouldn't come over here, never came in this, well, I think she did come in this building, but only after work to drink with Edward Graves. She'd never come here when we were in school.
Is that true? She refused to come?
Mm-hmm.
I'd heard that.
I think she did come over here on Friday nights when Eddie Graves was over here. You probably heard Eddie. He's from Lynchburg. He was an adjunct professor here. He would come over and fix martinis, and she'd come drink with him, I think.
So you say she was helpful to you both as a student and when you came join the faculty?
Yeah. Now, I preached her funeral.
I didn't know that.
And there's a story over there about her in the archive.
Well, preach to me about her. What? Tell me about her.
Well, I remember. See, Charlie, when she was retiring, it was not. I mean, she retired in 1976 because we were living in Toronto. I taught at Osgoode Hall Law School that winter in Toronto, and there was a retirement party for her, And I wrote a letter saying what a scoundrel she'd been or something like that, and said, God knows that if she had typed this letter, she would have changed it to make it look like I thought she was a nice person. I sent that to her, and I think I sent a copy to Charlie and John, because I'd known both them. Because our youngest son was born and went into labor. We left Charlie's house one night up in Alexandria, and she started having labor pains, and we went by the hospital, so that's how I remember that. So I'd known those two, Charlie and Catherine's boys. I'd known they were a little older than I. So anyway, I sent that letter to Charlie or something when she retired, and then when she died, he called me and said, would you deliver the eulogy at the funeral? Because A, she liked to drink, B, she was not a believer, and C, she was from Kentucky. So, so I did, and it was not very often in my life that I think I do something that's right, but I knew I did something right that day. And because most people were friends, but there were a few good, solid churchgoers, and they didn't quite know what to make of this whole thing. And it was out to great at Stonewall.